House Judiciary Committee come to order. House Committee on Judiciary, today is Friday, April 12th, 2013. We're going to jump into the work sessions. First, open a work session on House Bill 3201.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3201 is the wildfire bill we heard on March 27th that has the A7 amendment. And the A7 amendment provides that the state's ability to bring an action for unlawful taking of wildlife is not precluded by the bill and removes reference to res ipsa loquitur in Section 3.2 and instead establishes an explicit evidentiary standard. Thank you, Mr. Oh, there's a no revenue impact and no fiscal impact on the A7.
Is Representative Barton okay with this now?
Can you dispel what we just heard? What does this do?
Mr. Chair, allow me to say, let me specifically thank the proponents of this bill and my friend Heath Curtis in particular for graciously working with me. And also, I think Senator Dingfelder caused him even more problems than I did. He was a good sport about it all, and I like this bill very much.
Thank you.
Harvard wins.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the dash 7. Are you in a work session?
Yeah.
Dash 7 amendments into House Bill 3201. Representative Krieger moves the dash 7s into House Bill 3201. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House Bill 3201 as amended to the floor with a due pass.
Representative Krieger moves House Bill 3201 as amended to the floor with a due pass. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. I will carry the bill.
That's a good bill.
Yeah. 2581 that's on the agenda has come off. We're working on that a little bit more. Open a work session on House Bill 3282.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3282 was the bill we heard on March 27th from the Department of Justice. It was clarifies the appeal process for appeals filed before resolution of the case for victims appealing adverse rulings under the Victims Bill of Rights. There's no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
And no amendment.
No amendment.
No amendment.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House Bill 3282 to the floor with a due pass.
Representative Krieger moves House Bill 3282 to the floor with a due pass. Is there any discussion? Is there any objections? Hearing none, seeing none, so ordered. Yeah, we better. Barton, okay.
Happy to.
Thank you. Representative Barton will carry. Open a work session on House Bill 3286.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3286 was also from the Department of Justice. We heard this on March 27th. It removes requirement that oral statements supporting search warrants be transcribed. Has dash 2 amendment. It requires that oral statements be recorded and a copy provided to and retained by the judge who took the oral statement. The applicant shall retain a copy of the recording and provide it to the district attorney. It has a no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact on the dash 2.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the dash 2 amendments into House Bill 3286.
Representative Krieger moves the dash 2 amendments into 3286.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House Bill 3286 as amended.
You got a question? Any questions or any objections to the dash 2? It's ordered.
We're going to move this thing.
Friday afternoon.
Krieger and Barker.
That'll be quick around here. I'd like to move House Bill 3286 as amended to the floor with a due pass.
Representative Krieger moves House Bill 3286 as amended to the floor with a due pass. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. Representative Williamson, would you carry this for us, please?
Sure.
Okay, thank you. Yeah. Open a public hearing on House Bill 3478.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3478 adds claim of child abuse or knowingly allowing, permitting, or encouraging child abuse to the exemptions on filing an Oregon Tort Claims Act notice, provides exemption to the 2-year statute of limitation for child abuse against the public body, applies to causes of actions arising before, on, or after effective date, provides a mechanism to revive causes of action within 2 years for claims that failed because of failure to meet tort claim notice requirement or meet statute of limitation or statute of ultimate repose. There is no amendment at this time. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Kelly Clark, please.
It's former Representative Clark, in fact. Welcome home, Kelly.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Kelly Clark. I'm a lawyer in Portland.
And my practice for the last 10 years or so has focused on representing children and adults who, as children, were sexually abused. And I'm testifying at the request of Senator Starr in support of the bill. Oregon, starting in 1989, was one of the first states in the nation to recognize the reality that victims of child abuse oftentimes, in fact, usually, take years and decades to recognize what happened to them as children and to come forward and disclose and understand the impact that it had on them. Because of that, this legislature in 89 and then with repeated amendments over the years, the latest being 2009 that Representative Olson sponsored, has created a statute of limitations for child abuse cases, civil cases, that applies to everybody except the government. And that statute that applies to everybody except the government says you have the later period of time of age 40 or 5 years after you understand that this was abuse and that this abuse caused you injury. And it is, as I said, it's in keeping with what we know from the mental health community about the impact of child abuse on individuals and the time it takes for them to come forward. At the time the bill was passed and amended, to my knowledge, there was never any discussion or recognition that, well, wait a minute, if you go over here to the Oregon Tort Claims Act, which applies for tort claims against public bodies, there's a 2-year statute of limitations, period. And then there's the notice requirement as well. And what this bill does is to essentially close the loophole or remedy the injustice or both, depending upon your view. And it says that if you were victimized as a child, the standing statute of limitations applies to your claim, whether it is against an individual or a private organization or a public agency. That's what the bill does. It also eliminates the notice requirement, recognizing that, for crying out loud, most people, most kids at age 10, 12, 15, are not going to be able to give notice to the government that they might bring a civil claim, and that it is unlikely that they'll bring a civil claim within the standing 2-year statute of limitations that applies to public bodies. I'll give you just a very quick example. A couple of years ago, we represented a young woman who was born in 1989 to a drug-addicted mother. She was born physically deformed because of it. She had no portion of one arm, and she had other emotional, psychological difficulties. She was placed at age 1 through DHS with her biological grandmother. The problem was the biological grandmother was married to a man who had been twice convicted for sexually abusing children in their home. DHS knew this. She was, by age 5, being sexually abused by this individual, and that continued for about 6 years until it was finally discovered and he was convicted for 75 counts of child sexual abuse. During that period of time, the 10 years from 89 to 99, there were 14 separate warnings to DHS complaints about abuse or neglect in this home. Notwithstanding that, she was left in the home. We brought a case against DHS on her behalf. She's a delightful woman. She has worked through, she's 23 now, worked through an incredible lifetime of difficulties and adversity. We were going to lose that case on the statute of limitations because despite the fact that she came forward relatively early for child abuse victims, it was more than 2 years after the last act of abuse. We were going to lose that case. We had to settle it right before summary judgment. Probably 100 times in the last 10 years, I've received calls from people who were abused by governmental agents, juvenile probation officers in one case, one notorious case, public school teachers, people in the care of DHS, and others. And consistently, I have to say to them, unfortunately, the law has no justice for you because you happen to have the double misfortune of A, being abused as a child, and B, being abused as a child by a governmental actor. And because of that, your statute of limitations passed 2 years after you were abused. So for this woman, the statute passed when she was 13. And so we had some very creative arguments to try to get around the statute of limitations, but ultimately it was our judgment that they were not going to be successful. So there's no logical distinction for this disparate treatment. There's certainly no justice for the person that was abused in the context of a governmental entity, and we would encourage your consideration of this bill and your passage. One final thought. I understand there may be some budgetary concern here, and I'd like to address that head on. The legislature and the public policy of the state of Oregon has seen fit to address the budgetary concerns about tort claims against the government through the tort claims cap, which artificially limits the amount of damages that people can receive. That discussion, that public policy consideration, has already been done, had, sealed. It's part of the law of the state of Oregon. And it seems to me that budgetary concerns are no reason to justify, as I call it, an illogical and unjust distinction between claims against private individuals and entities and claims against public individuals and entities. I'm happy to take questions from you, Mr. Chair, or comments or questions from members of the committee. Thank you.
Any questions from the committee? Thank you, Mr. Clark. Peter Mercereau, Amy Wason.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, I am Peter Mercereau. I appreciate the opportunity to come before you and offer a few comments on HB 3478. By trade, I am a trial lawyer in the defense of school districts, public entities, in tort litigation in state and federal court, including child abuse claims, and I'm here today in opposition to this bill, and on behalf of the Special Districts of Oregon and OSBA and PACE. As Mr. Clark just indicated, the proposed bill does add a significant amendment to the Tort Claims Act, and it does so by severely limiting the statute of limitations defense currently available to public entities in child abuse cases. And basically what this bill does, in no small measure, is incorporate into public sector litigation involving child abuse the statute of limitations that now applies in private sector child abuse claims, which entitles a victim of child abuse to sue, or limits the period of time in which a child abuse victim can sue until they are 40, or a period of 5 years from the date of discovery of the claim. So currently, in non-governmental cases involving child abuse, a victim has until he or she is 40 years old, or until he or she has discovered the claim, and then 5 years later, whichever of those two periods is longer. Currently, with regard to the public sector, the Oregon Tort Claims Act provides for a 2-year statute of limitations covering child abuse claims. Now, I would suggest to you that the loophole that you just heard about was not, in fact, a loophole in 1989 when the private sector statute was passed. And if, in fact, it had been proposed at that time that the same statute apply to public sector tort claims, there would have been a vibrant debate, there would have been testimony such as I'm giving you, and there would have been a discussion by those representing the public sector as to what the impact of that statute of limitations would be. I suggest to you that the immediate impact of this bill, were it to be passed, would be a significant increase in the number of child abuse claims against public entities. That is the bottom line. As soon as this bill went into effect, you'll notice that, among other things, there is a revival of the prior time-barred causes of action. That would mean claims that literally may have been unavailable or dismissed 20 years ago would now spring back to life. But even more importantly, looking ahead prospectively, what this bill would mean is that now the statute of limitations for child abuse in claims against public entities would involve a statute that effectively relates back to the age of 40 or discovery plus 5 years, whichever is longer, as opposed to the two-year statute that is currently in play. Now, let me take a moment and talk about a recent case in the Oregon Supreme Court. This is a case you may have read about involving the Lake Oswego School District, and this is a case involving the very two-year statute of limitations that I just mentioned. In that Lake Oswego case, a group of 40 and 50-year-old individuals, I believe there were six or seven plaintiffs, brought abuse claims against the Lake Oswego School District arising out of inappropriate touching that had occurred when they were fifth graders, 30 and 40 years before the claims were brought. The school district immediately raised the two-year statute of limitations as a defense to that claim and argued in the trial court in a very preliminary motion that the court should hold as a matter of law that any fifth grader who is an 11 or 12-year-old should have known that the inappropriate touching that was alleged in that case was wrongful and was abuse, and thereafter he or she had 2 years to bring a claim under the statute. The trial court agreed with that argument and dismissed the lawsuit. The Court of Appeals agreed with the trial court's ruling and affirmed it, and then the Oregon Supreme Court reversed both the trial court and the Court of Appeals and held in a written opinion several months ago that the discovery doctrine that had long since been in effect in Tort Claims Act cases should apply in this case, which means that the two-year statute of limitations does not begin to run until, in this case, the child abuse victim knew or should have known that he or she has a claim for abuse. And this, in the court's view, brought into play many of these so-called relational factors that are unique to child abuse claims. Concepts of grooming, concepts of the positions between the parties. You may have read about these in the scoutmaster-scout context, priest-parishioner context. Those are relational kinds of issues that are unique to child abuse claims. And what the court said is, we can't decide as a matter of law that any fifth grader should have known that he or she had an abuse claim, and therefore a jury should decide that. And so the case was remanded back to the trial court, where it still is. What is significant about the Lake Oswego case, I suggest to you, is that the court, first of all, in no manner ever referred to ORS 12.117, which is the private sector statute that this bill before you is incorporating now into the Tort Claims Act. Supreme Court never held that it was unfair to have a different statute of limitations for public sector defendants. The Supreme Court never held that the two-year statute of limitations, and has never held, is unconstitutional in any way. What it held in that case was that the discovery doctrine should apply, and that many of these fact questions about who should have discovered, should have known, are for a jury, and that a court, under very limited circumstances, should decide as a matter of law that the statute of limitations has run. And so I suggest to you that in terms of the Lake Oswego case, the law right now allows any child abuse victim, no matter his age, could be 30, 40, or 50, to make a claim of child abuse and prove or attempt to prove that despite the fact the abuse occurred years and years ago, they couldn't have discovered it. And that'll be a jury question. I believe that is the sum and substance of that Lake Oswego case. Now, an issue has been raised about parity. I heard the term disparate treatment. Why would you treat public sector employees differently than private sector employees? This committee knows, and bills come before you all the time seeking amendments to the Oregon Tort Claims Act. The fact is, the existence of the Oregon Tort Claims Act is in and of itself a form of disparate treatment and always has been. As you know, that act represents a waiver of sovereign immunity. Before 1968, you couldn't sue a public body or any of its employees because of that doctrine. In 1968, Oregon, and it joined the rest of the states, waived sovereign immunity by passing the Tort Claims Act. But in doing so, it was a limited waiver. And so you see damage caps that the private sector doesn't have. You see an exclusion for workers' comp remedies that the private sector doesn't have. You see discretionary function immunity that the private sector doesn't have. And all of these things relate back to what used to be the protections of the so-called sovereign, and they're all cost-driven. And so every time the Oregon Tort Claims Act is amended to reduce a defense, raise damages, or eliminate an immunity, there are cost consequences. And I suggest to you that in this particular case, there's a reason for that disparity, that so-called disparate treatment, and it all relates to the ability of the public bodies to defend themselves in these claims and the costs associated with it. I think, as my colleague, Mr. Clark, would agree, the challenges to the defense of these cases is the sheer amount of time between the event and the claim. Often, the recovered memory claims and what have you, often the perpetrator or alleged perpetrator is long gone, witnesses are long gone, and they're enormously difficult to defend. And that is what incurs much of the cost. So I don't believe there was, in fact, a loophole that needs to be closed from the 1989 case. And I respectfully suggest to you that the Lake Oswego decision does not create a basis for challenging the or amending the Tort Claims Act, and that the bill should not pass. And I'd be happy to take any questions.
Mr. Mishra, somebody who is a proponent of the bill came to me and said, why should the school district be different than the Boy Scouts? If you're going to allow them to go after the Boy Scouts or child abuse, why would you protect the schools? And I've heard some of the things you said, but I mean, that's a pretty direct question. And I mean, realizing that for the most part, people who try to sue the abuser doesn't have any money. So they're going to go for the bigger, they're going after the bigger place. And if there's negligence on the part of the school district, why wouldn't they be able to have this same as they do with the scouts, for example?
It is all a question of the cost. And the reasons why the other defenses and immunities are in the Tort Claims Act, very simply, is to protect the public fisc. That's the whole basis of discretionary function, the workers' comp. You could say the exact same thing. Why should a driver who happens to collide with a public employee and who happens to have been in the course and scope of his or her employment, why should she be excluded from a remedy when, if that driver had hit a private party, there would be a remedy? And the answer is, it's in the Tort Claims Act, and it was the wisdom of the legislature when it first passed the act to include that immunity as a measure of saving public dollars. And I don't know how else to answer that.
Okay, that's fine. Thank you, Representative Martin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, sir, thank you for your testimony. By the way, I agree with your reading of the Lake Oswego case. In light of that holding, being that this is, in effect, already the law, which I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I think that's...
It is. Again,
then what is the downside, cost-wise, to this legislation?
The downside?
Yeah, it's already kind of law via discovery rule, is it not?
Well, the discovery rule is the law, but only for 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
The downside is it's now until somebody is 40.
I see.
It's just a simple matter of the math. If this bill were to be passed, instead of having 2 years from you when you knew or should have known, you can literally know. Take a 17-year-old who knows, let's assume a hypothetical case where a 17-year-old has had a relationship with an adult in the school system, let's say a teacher. That technically is statutory rape. It's also child abuse.
Right.
And let's assume that 17-year-old has the mental acuity and the experience to know that's child abuse. He or she doesn't have to sue if this bill passes until she's 40 or he's 40. That's the difference. The purpose of the shorter statute of limitations is to give the defendant an opportunity to investigate a claim, defend it, settle it, or try it, and not have to wait 25 or 30 years, by which time the evidence is stale, witnesses are gone, and it's a much more difficult defense.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Parrish, go ahead.
Thank you. Colleagues, for the record, Julie Parrish, House District 37, and I'm sorry for not getting here at the start of this. We have a full docket in House Ed, and I didn't know where the room was because I've never been in this room before. So that can just show you how much I interact with the judiciary issues that happen in this building. But you know what? I appreciate the opportunity to have this bill heard. And just from a personal background connection, you know, most of you know, or everybody I think knows, that my sister died a few years ago, and it really wasn't until she had gone to jail the first time that we knew that somebody had sexually assaulted her when she was 13, and certainly had precipitated some of the events of spiraling out of control in life as just one of the mitigating factors. And the fact of it is that this gentleman got to go off and continue to be a, you know, prosperous in life, and she went through a life of hell and misery. So, kids don't always come forward. Kids don't always feel safe to talk about issues. And if it takes people years, and it does sometimes, to be able to get come to terms with something pretty horrific, then I think we need to give those victims time to process, time to work through that process, and then time to be able to come to the authorities and feel like they are ready to come back and face somebody who has assaulted them, has potentially taken away their childhood or their life. So I'm, from a technical perspective, probably can't answer a lot of the questions of this because I'm not a lawyer. I do not have the fancy law degree. But from a how we treat people perspective, I can speak to that probably better than anybody in this room and with a lot of depth. So I support this bill. I'd love to see this committee move this bill and provide relief to victims and their families, even for people sometimes that will never see that relief. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Amy Wason, members of the committee. I am the Senior Vice President and General Counsel at Oregon Health and Science University, and appreciate your hearing my remarks today. We understand and support the intent of this bill to ensure that children who are emotionally, sexually, physically abused at the hand of a public body are afforded appropriate time to bring a claim. It goes without saying, and we've had others comment on the level of trauma visited on children, and as said, we're supportive of allowing appropriate time. What the reason that we are here today is that we're requesting a clarifying amendment to the bill. As drafted, House Bill 3478 incorporates a definition of child abuse that reads, that includes the following as child abuse, quote, intentional conduct by an adult that results in any physical injury to a child. I work for a healthcare institution, and worry that this language is broad enough to be interpreted as encompassing non-criminal activity such as the delivery of healthcare. I mean, read literally, if our care providers at Dornbecker are providing care, they're intentionally doing something, and there is a risk that that might result in injury to a child. And that's a negligence context, not a child, in my view, a child abuse context. And in order to clarify, we understand that, and our sense is that this bill was never intended to reach to negligence in a healthcare context. And in order to clarify that, we would request that an amendment be considered that is specific on that point. We suggest language that reads as follows, quote, this paragraph C does not apply to negligence in the provision of health care, unquote. We've worked with the proponents of the bill to draft this amendment, and our understanding through that work is that this this would be consistent, that adding the amendment would be consistent with the intent of House Bill 3478. With that amendment, then we would be supportive of it. I'm happy to take questions, and I thank you again for your time.
Thank you, and I would just say that we meet every year with the Chief Justice or somebody, and maybe we talk about the necessity of drafting clear laws. If it doesn't say it, it's not the law. And so we appreciate you catching that so we don't have some unintended consequences should the bill pass.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Ken Crowley and Lanny Reeves.
Thank you.
Chair Barker. Identify yourself further.
Thank you, Chair Barker. Members of the committee, my name is Leonie Reeves. I'm general counsel to the governor. I am going to defer to Mr. Crowley from the trial division, and I'm here to answer any questions if you have any at the end.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Ken Crowley. I'm the acting attorney in charge for the civil litigation section of the trial division of the Oregon Department of Justice. And in that capacity, I supervise approximately 17 lawyers who handle litigation responsibilities for the state of Oregon in state and federal courts. A group of lawyers within the section that I supervise, approximately three or four lawyers currently, have a significant caseload of cases involving Department of Human Services, foster care abuse, and so forth. Those cases, as you know, have a significant impact on the state of Oregon and on DHS. They are often high-profile cases. We've seen them in the news quite a bit. And they have large dollar figures associated with them, with litigation expenses, with attorney's fees, and with cost of resolution. In the last few years, one of the significant things that we've seen in connection with those cases, which impacts those cases, is the change in the tort claims limit. Over the last few years, we've seen costs, attorney's fees, and expenses related to those cases go up approximately 400% because of the change in the tort cap limits. From a number that's somewhere in the neighborhood of a few million dollars to a number that's in the neighborhood of $12 to $15 million. So that's what we're looking at currently. If this legislation is in place, and I want to preface my remarks by saying I'm not taking a position on this legislation, but I want to speak to, you know, what the impact of this legislation will be for the Department of Justice and for the state of Oregon. So if this legislation is passed, it will have a huge impact. What we're going to see is the number of cases will continue to grow. It will grow exponentially. And the amount of resources that the state has to devote to these cases is going to grow exponentially. The other thing that I think is, and when I say that, I'm talking about tens and hundreds of millions of dollar range. That's what we're talking about with these cases. We will have to add lawyers. These cases will be more difficult to defend, and the reason for that is because many of these cases will be older, and the evidence will be harder to gather, and so we will be put in a position of defending cases that are more difficult. And so, bottom line, there's going to be a great impact on the work that we do in the Department of Justice because of these cases. The other thing I wanted to speak to was policy implications. Now, none of us, everybody in this room hates the idea of child abuse. It's a terrible thing. We want to prevent it every way we can. The cases that we are currently dealing with have policy implications. They affect the Department of Human Services and how they operate. When a significant case comes along and there is evidence of a problem within the Department of Human Services as a result of that case, policy changes take place. The kinds of cases which this legislation involve, the older cases, cases that arose many, many years ago but are not discovered until present day, there will not be the same kind of policy implications for those cases because those cases involve things that were happening at a different time, involve practices and procedures which likely will have changed by the time the case comes to trial. So the impact of those cases on how government operates will not be the same. That is essentially what I wanted to talk to you about today. If you have any questions for me, I'm happy to answer.
Representative Krueger. A couple times a day, questions or people made comments about DHS. I want you to get us a list of the number of cases that have been filed since 2009, in other words, 9, 10, 11, and 12, the cost of defending them, and how many were settled out of court, and the amount of those court settlements.
Fair enough. I'm sure that that information is in the works, and we can provide that for you.
Any further questions? Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a statement and then a comment to the committee. You know, I've had the pleasure of litigating against some of your colleagues and some of the lawyers who work against you on several occasions. Recently, with Dirk Pearson, for example, you really have a good group of lawyers working for you. They are public servants. They are working for under what their fair wage would be. And I just wanted to acknowledge that.
That's very much appreciated. Yeah. And Dirk Pearson would have been here today if he could, but he is in Deschutes County in court.
But having said that, I have to, the primary arguments,
you're talking hundreds of millions of dollars.
The primary arguments against this legislation are cost-driven, i.e. that this increased exposure will increase costs to public entities. And that's accurate, but still, nonetheless, not doing so, we're making a policy choice of shifting cost from victims, people who have been sexually abused, we're not compensating them at the rates we should be. That's the cost choice we're making, and it's a pretty easy one for me. I recognize the real fiscal impact in a time of straight budget, but I think that this is an opportunity here to set things right. My personal opinion, it's unsurprising. As everyone knows, it's not a technical conflict, but I do this kind of work, so I have pretty strong feelings about this, but I think this is a real opportunity for us, colleagues.
Thank you very much. We're obviously the bill's not ready to go today, so we'll close the public hearing. House Bill 3478. We're going to reopen, we'll go to a work session on House Bill 2944. We just got the fiscal information in its minimal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2944 was the Uniform Electronic Legal Materials Act. We just heard this week on last Wednesday, April 10th. This has no amendment, has no revenue impact, and a minimal fiscal impact. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House Bill 2944 to the floor with the due pass.
Representative Krueger moves House Bill 2944 to the floor with the due pass. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. I will ask, we'll ask Representative Davis to carry the bill. And we want to roll House Bill 2581 over till Wednesday. Any further business to come before the committee? Have a good weekend, please.